Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, you can go to pnwa.org. We just finished up our yearly writers conference this past weekend, and it was fabulous. I was there teaching and helping out. If I saw you there, hello. If not, maybe I'll see you there next time. If you did go to any of the classes, you might have heard me talk about stories and the two kinds of questions, I think, that exist, the two levels of questions that exist in every story. The first level is the level of what is going to happen next. What's going to happen next? Is the guy going to get the girl? Is the monster going to be killed? Is the killer going to be caught? Will the father give his son approval? What's going to happen next? This is the entertainment questions. But then many stories also have another level of question, which is, why is all this stuff happening? What does it mean? What is the value of life when we know we're all going to die? What is it about? That's the second level of question that some stories deal with more than others. That is the question I admit, if you've listened to this show, you're probably aware I am particularly interested in and always have been since I was a young man. And I believe today's guest is interested in it as well. My guest is Carl Kallman. He's the author of the Paradigm Shift Trilogy, Global Mind and the Rise of Civilization is the first installment of that. He is a PhD, he holds a PhD in physical biology, and was a senior researcher at the University of Washington, and has written a number of extensively quoted articles in scientific literature in the fields of environmental science, chemistry, and cancer research. But in 1979, he took a little backpacking trip to Mexico and Guatemala, and things began to change for him at that point, when he discovered, among other things, the Mayan calendar, which began a shift in his mind, which led eventually to the book that he's just published, and the subject of the difference between the brain and the mind. A difference, I think, relevant to all people, especially creative folks like you listening out there. That's what I believe. Let's find out what Carl thinks. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bill. Good to be on it.
Well, it's great to have you on it. There's so much to talk about. Let's quickly start with your little backpacking trip. the Mayan calendar, which has a lot of, it got a lot of attention a couple years back. What was it about a calendar from an ancient peoples that made you rethink sort of what it is to be human?
As you said, I made a backpacking trip when I was 29, and I had already started my graduate studies in toxicology and chemistry and these kind of things, but felt I needed a break from the test tubes and the instruments and all that kind of stuff. And I got it more than I expected, you might say. And this is before internet and everything, to go to Mexico from Sweden, where I was living on then, that was a bigger adventure, not a lot of contact, you might say. It was sort of throwing yourself into an adventure in another way. And arriving unbeknownst to myself on the Day of the Dead in Mexico City. finding myself in the midst of these skeleton hanging from the light poles and all that stuff that comes with the Mexican culture and so forth. And I then took a third class train down to the Yucatan Peninsula from Mexico City. And again, third class train in those days is not what it is today. I don't think if they even have it, but in those days it meant you really did, you were it's sort of a constant train market was what you entered, and you shared your, literally shared your place with the chickens and the pigs and so forth. So it was colorful. And But the point is really that when I came down to the Yucatan and Guatemala, I did feel a very strong affinity for the people, the indigenous Maya and other people there. And I also encountered their calendar system, which was so profoundly different that I thought from what I had been taught and what I learned, basically because the time periods, whether we're talking about single days or longer periods of time, were associated, or you might say they were assigned certain spiritual qualities. And so they would be symbolized by certain spiritual symbols. And this sort of struck me as kind of surprising. And even more so the fact that they had a calendar that wasn't based on any astronomical cycles. In other words, the calendar was a sequence of spiritual qualities that was not based on the physical material reality as we know it. And they talked about this calendar as a sacred calendar. And all this fascinated me. It dawned upon me that this could be the opening for a completely different worldview than I had been used to in rational-minded, secular right. Sweden science environment where I came from. But that at the time, I didn't start thinking deeply about the matter, but I did feel that maybe they're all right. Maybe they are completely right, and that this kind of a calendar is much more meaningful when it comes to understanding life, how it evolves, and our own, as you talked about in the introduction, our own what are we here for, and these kind of things. So that's how my interest started, you might say.
That's how it started. Now, that's fascinating. And you, as you said, you came from the rational, Western, secular, European.
Yeah.
This was your model, and so growing up. Of course, Christianity plays a big role in Europe, but there's also a strong strain of sort of atheistic, strongly secular beliefs as well. Was your family, did they have any kind of spiritual life in it, or was it really just, as I described, rational and secular?
Well, I would say that in my particular case, it was very rational and secular. And Sweden is actually an unusual country in this regard in Europe. It is the least religious. On the other
hand,
the country. Yes, it is by far. Okay. I would say, but. On the other hand, it has some kind of a pagan traditions that no other European country has.
Okay.
So it sort of has taken a little bit of another turn. People really have a very spiritual connection to nature and so forth. But certainly not a strong religious country at this point in time, and not in my upbringing.
And so you said something very interesting when you noticed the calendar, the Mayan calendar, which had a sort of a spiritual quality, but wasn't based, and I don't know the particulars of the Mayan calendar, but wasn't based on the physical reality, whereas in the Gregorian calendar is based on the sun, I assume, and the rotation of the earth, so on, the physical world. I have scientific friends, and of course, what we're going to talk about now, of course, is the difference between the brain, which is the thing I could actually hold in my hands, the lump of gray matter I could cut into pieces, theoretically, and then what you call mind, which to me is something non-physical. Would you describe it that way?
Yeah.
Okay. Right? Is that the difference? One is physical, one is non-physical. And some people say there is no difference, that mind and brain are all one and the same. What do you say?
Well, it's been a debate for a long time, and certainly within the scientific community, it's almost accepted as truth that the mind is created by the brain. But my view is then completely opposite. And what I think I do in this new book, The Global Mind and the Rise of Civilization, is really to prove that the mind does not come from the brain. Rather, the mind is something that the brain is in resonance with or downloads or whatever. And whatever word you would like to use, because it's hard to find the exact word.
Receive. You know, and the reason I say receive is this. So I talk to creative people, and I'm a creative person myself, and every creative person who looks like they're thinking, because they're sitting by themselves, I mean writers, I should say, because we sit there, and creative writers are sitting there, just they look like they're thinking. But if you really talk to them about what's happening, it's much more akin to receiving something, a kind of tuning in, waiting, as opposed to thinking like I think when I'm balancing my checkbook. That feels more like thinking to me a little bit. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And, you know, this is really very much my own experience of being a writer. This is my fifth book, I think, that is internationally published. And I receive the book. It's more like the book is already out there in some kind of concept in the sky or whatever it is. Yeah. And my role is to write it down. And of course, you know, it's like whatever this concept comes from, it probably feels that I'm a good guy to write this particular book because I have a scientific training. And so I take the pains to check everything and check the facts and the logic and all that kind of stuff. But I just find where the book is going and try to do the best of explaining what it's there. And when I look upon when I've started writing books, for the most part, it's not like I'm sitting there thinking, analyzing, and trying to come up with some idea.
Right.
It's rather something comes to me and I cannot stop. I cannot stop once when these, I guess you relate to that.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, one of the things when I teach writing, a lot of what I teach is, and I think it's really important, and I'm so glad we're talking about this, because the West and their relationship to science is very profound. Science has played such a huge role in that I couldn't be talking to you right now were it not for science, right? And it's played a huge part in our life. It's made us safe. It's given us air conditioning and heating and nuclear bombs and all the rest and medicine.
Yeah.
But a lot of the thing writers have to deal with is that rational model doesn't really describe what they're doing. And for a lot of the creative people, it's a kind of a dirty secret in a way. Like, the fact is I feel like I'm listening to somebody. Because they've been told smart people don't think like that, right?
No,
I mean, this is part of the thing.
Yeah.
Smart people, it's all mechanical.
Yeah, right. That's that is a perception, but what you do notice with famous scientists is that once they got the Nobel Prize and really have nothing more to gain or nothing more to lose, then they will start telling the real story of how they come up with this idea in a dream or in a psychedelic state or whatever happened.
Really? I've never heard that.
Okay.
God, you could write a book just of those stories. That would be fantastic.
I guess.
No, all right. No, you know, actually, I take it back. You should never write a book that someone else tells you to write. People have done that with me, and you've got to write what you want to write because those are the things that come to you. Okay, so you're a scientist. And now you're talking about the difference between the mind and the brain. You're saying there's a physical part of our reality and there's a non-physical part of our reality. How does the scientific community respond to that? How do you talk to the scientific community about it? What do you do?
Not really. It's 20 years ago since I left that particular hard sciences career, and so yes, I do have contacts with some of them from old friends and so forth. But as soon as I get into my stuff, that's really not what they want to talk about, and so. Basically, my work is overall it is ignored by the scientific community. Right. And I think it is ignored because it's something they would not be very easy. It would not be very easy to debunk what I'm saying, and so they don't want to go into it a little bit because then it might go further and a lot of change would be needed in how the scientific community looks upon the world.
You know, one of the things your book deals with is something I think is. I find fascinating, and is collective consciousness. Collective consciousness. This is a word we hear bandied about some, just sort of almost pop culture. But what does that mean? What is what is your definition of collective consciousness, and how is it relevant to just my everyday life?
Well, you know, I certainly am aware of that concept, and what my book talks about is a little bit of a different concept, which is global mind. And basically, the view that I'm presenting in this book, present a lot of evidence of it, is that our individual minds are connected to an evolving global mind. And this global mind actually is partly comes out of the core of the earth, and we're all connected to it. And so what I'm talking about, among other things, is the fact that 5,100 years ago, which is a shift point in the Mayan calendar, you find that in very separate places in the world, people start to build pyramids. You found them from this time, from Peru, from Egypt, from Mongolia, and then I go on to talk about these kind of things, that something shifted in the global mind that made people suddenly start to create civilizations, cities, pyramids, writing, counting, etc., independently at the same time. And so this really proves that there is something like a collective consciousness. If you read the whole book, so to speak, then you will see that. We are connected. Our minds are all connected to a global mind, and that gives our minds a framework, even though we have individual minds as well, or we use this global mind in different ways once we have downloaded it. But it evolves, and the reason that humanity evolves in some sense is the fact that there is an independent of the human beings, there is a global mind that evolves according to the time plan of the Mayan calendar. That's what the book lays out.
You know, my son, my youngest son, who is a very unusual fellow and came at life very differently, the first time I talked to him about evolution was when I was watching a Simpsons episode, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And they had a very funny intro that showed mankind evolving from apes to human to Homer Simpson and then devolving back to apes. That's the joke. So we were watching that, and he said, "Why are you laughing?" He was very young at this point. And I explained it's evolution. He said, "What's evolution?" So I explained evolution to him, and then he paused and he said, "So what will humans evolve into?" Which is something I never hear people talking about when they talk about evolution. It's always, it's over. It's over. But to me, the evolution is thought. It has to be thought, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that where, I mean, isn't democracy evolution? Isn't peace evolution? Isn't Barack Obama? I mean, isn't that all evolution?
Yeah, sure.
But we think of it only in physical terms. It's thought of only in physical terms, but for us it must be in terms of how we think,
exactly
what we perceive.
Yeah. I would, in my view, it isn't a physical phenomena. It is all ultimately a metaphysical processes that are behind the evolution, even of the biological species. But that is not recognized, so to speak.
Now, so you go on to you sort of take a scientific approach to this concept of mind. And want to look at trying to give evidence give evidence for what you have come to understand. But a lot of times, sometimes I, and writers will say this all the time, that we write to understand why we know something. In other words, yeah. I know it on a felt level, then I write to understand why I know it. So on some level, did you feel like you knew this thing called mind first and then went in search of evidence to support it, which I, by the way, I'm perfectly in support of? Was it was that the direction of it? Okay.
Yeah, I would say so. What happened with this particular book is that I started, you know, had some idea of a book that would describe the process of human history of the past 5,000 years. And then I of course, at an early point in that process is the building of the Egyptian pyramids. And then came a realization that this is actually a symbol of the global mind. That's what they did. And because at that point in time, they started to download a new kind of a mind. And once I had that insight, which sort of is more of an insight coming from some collective intelligence, you might say, then it was a matter of really providing all the proofs and all the things that would make this a reasonable thought to for those that want to go into it and see the details and so forth. So I would say so. Yeah, I agree. My same experience. You start with the inside, and then you have to write to make it clear and to make it even to yourself make it clear.
That's right.
But yeah. And as you make it clear to yourself, you make it clear to others.
That's right. That's right. In order to make it clear to others, you make it clear to yourself, and in so doing, you learn more about it yourself. In fact, it reminds me, you know the old expression, seeing is believing? And I actually think it's backwards. I think that believing is seeing. I think that you don't see evidence of something until you believe that thing exists.
Right.
Does that make so? In other words, you know, if you don't believe something is possible, you will ignore the evidence of its existence. So you first have to believe something exists. But science says it has to be the other way around. But I just don't think as human beings it's how we work.
No,
I think we believe
first.
You're
right. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And when I think about collective consciousness, I think it was Einstein who said this, but he gets so many things attributed to him. Maybe he didn't, but I don't care. Let's just say he did.
Time.
Yeah, everything brilliant gets assigned to Einstein. You know it's right because he said it. But
exactly,
I think he was the one who said, genius is curiosity. I think he said that.
That
sounds about right.
That's possible, I think. Yeah.
It feels true to me. And so in other words, and this is what it reminds me, this is why I think of collective consciousness or the global mind. In other words, we all have access to it, but your pathway to that is your curiosity. Your asking will be that which received. Does that make sense? So in other words, the more focused and interested you are in something, the more information about it you'll receive.
Yeah.
Does that match up with what you've come to understand about the mind?
Yes, it does. But it's also there is also something here that is even a little bit more magical, you might say, that when you start working a book, which in this case it took about 2 years for me to write or to complete rather, and you get so focused on a particular topic, it's almost like you stay in character, as they say about actors, that so you stay in the character of the book, you might say, that in the most mysterious ways the very relevant information comes to you. It's like because when I write my book, I sometimes rely on articles that are in the scientific literature, and which today covers, I mean, hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of different articles. And sometimes it just happens that in some way just the right article among these millions just pops up on my computer in one way or another when I'm searching. searching for something else or something like that. And that, I believe, happens because you stay in character. You stay in, you are the book while you write these kind of things. And that's I would think that this is exactly what happens to somebody who writes also a fictional thing that all the stories come.
Carl, it does. That, you know, it's so funny as you were describing that. I just love to hear these stories. What you just described is such a common experience for writers of all stripes. And for some reason, I wasn't sure if you were going to report that same thing yourself, because most of the people I talk to are memoirists or novelists. There's a few more nonfiction writers like yourself, but not so much. But it is so gratifying for me to hear that writing is writing is writing. Whether you're trying to prove a grand global theme about humanity or writing a romance novel, the experience remains strangely the same. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Provided that you are the kind of serious writer that goes into the book and becomes the book, you might say. I can imagine that there are some people who sort of write a little bit more leisurely, like, what should I write now, or something like that. But,
Everybody takes their work very seriously, but it's just that for some people, what they seriously want to do is entertain people. You know, it's just a different thing. But it's so cool that, because here's a very nonfiction book, but it's still a creative act. It really doesn't matter, does it? That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it. Mm. Well, so we only got about 3 minutes left here, Carl, and this has gone way too quick. And I've got one caller, and I'm sorry I won't be able to get to you. But all right, so talk to me about this. So we got 3 minutes left. How does the idea, it's a very sort of theoretical idea, it's almost academic, but everything, my favorite teacher said, if spirituality isn't practical, it's not spirituality. So how does the idea of a collective mind, of a global mind, how does that apply to me in my everyday life? How is it a day-to-day of value?
Well, I think it what it does is that it tells you that your mind or what you do such as your mind is actually part of a divine plan, a divine time plan for the evolution of the universe, including our own or planet, and that. That is a sort of a meaningful thing to know, I think. You know, we often find that life may be not what we thought we wanted, or certainly not the world is not functioning according to these kind of standards. But whatever you think about it, what I've shown here is that we are part of a time plan that is hard to give any other origin than just to say this is divine, this is it's going somewhere, it's come from somewhere, it's going somewhere, and we have a choice to be part of it, and that I believe is a very meaningful thing to know, whatever we make of it. It's simply not true to say that life is an accident and what happens is just accidental. No, there is an overall plan, and that's what I have described in this book. The global mind and the rise of civilization. Yeah,
that is beautiful, and I couldn't agree more.
Thank you.
It is. I do not believe it is a mechanical universe. I believe it is an intentional universe, an intentional conscious universe. Well, Carl, I can't believe our time is up. Thank you so much. So once again, it is the Paradigm Shift Trilogy, and the book is called The Global Mind and the Rise of Civilization. Well, good luck with it. I hope you get to reach lots and lots of people.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carl. So there you go. See, you're a part of something. You're a part of, you know it. You know you're a part of something. You know you're not alone. You just know it. We're all connected. Connected by love. That's what we're connected by, all right, in our mind. Well, all right, next week I'm going to be taking a move toward the fiction, talking to Bruce Holbert, who's written another fine novel. And until then, you know what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to find what you're interested in and do it. Tune into your curiosity. Tune into it all the time. All the time. Day after day. Moment after moment. And someone might even call you a genius. It's true. That's how it happens. It's that simple. Just get curious.